This podcast is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is growing their team with offices and remote teams across the globe. Visit shopify.com/careers to learn more.
So I've got a really good HIPAA joke for you.
Uh-huh.
But I can't tell you what it is. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sean. So, Sean, what's been going on with you this week?
Well, let me tell you about the most nightmarish debugging experience I've had in a very, very, very long time.
Please go on.
So, the failure manifests itself as this test said, we expected this query to get run and it didn't get run. And, you know, there are several hundred or thousands of queries that get run during this test.
Sure.
So,
and was this like... was this trying to validate that the query was cached or that like when it, so it's the query doesn't get run or does get run? Sorry.
The query does not get run. It was expecting it to get run.
Okay.
And then I believe there was a second failure, which we never saw because it just fails on the first one. But I believe there was a second case where it would have also then failed later saying also expect this query to run again and hit the query cache that time.
Uh-huh.
Because as it turns out, it was getting run two fewer times than it should have. Or at least than the test was expecting it to. It's actually behaving completely perfectly fine. But and I figured that was going to end up being the case. But you still, you know, I can't just say that and say, no, we'll just change the test. It's fine until I'd actually figured out the real root cause.
Right.
So I paired with somebody on my team on this, and we eventually narrowed it down to this specific method on our line item class that was being called four fewer times than it should have. On master, it was called 269 times, and on this branch, it was called 265 times.
Okay.
So, find the four times that didn't happen, basically, was the name of the game. Figure out why this method was getting called only 265 times.
Uh-huh.
So, like
global hash of caller stack traces?
No.
Every time this method gets called and then diff between the two branches?
No, because the problem was the stack trace was basically identical on all of them. And even if it was different, like this got called from views. So the stack traces were so mangled that between one run to the
sure.
next, you couldn't reasonably compare them.
Oh my God. So what ended up being the solution?
Well, so the way we tracked this down was if global variable is true, log. And then just started setting the global variable for half of the test and then
uh-huh.
paring it down to another half and continuing until we got down to a single line. And eventually we narrowed it down to a single call to checkout.save, where it was called six times on master and four times on this branch.
Uh-huh. Were there two calls to checkout.save through the
no.
entire execution of it? Oh, no.
I actually don't know where the other two missing
calls came from.
But it's the same. It's almost certainly the same root cause.
Sure.
So it's unfortunate, though, that we found it on checkout.save, because now we are out of Shopify code and all that's left is Rails code. So like it would either there were some monkey patches that Shopify
sure.
had, but we ruled those out pretty quickly. They weren't stuff that could have caused this. So now we're like, it's got to be a callback. So we monkey patched run callbacks to just like spit out, you know, what kind of callback it was. And we saw on master, save, method is called twice, update, method is called four times. And on the branch, save, update, method is called four times. And there's our two missing method calls. They happen in a before save callback, except this model doesn't have any before save callbacks.
Okay. I'm guessing some extreme monkey patching is happening.
No, it's way just... it's nothing like that terrible, but it is more, will make you more sad.
Go on, tell me.
So anyway, so at this point, right, we now have narrowed it down to, we know exactly this one call that happened at this exact point in time on master is the one that's missing. So now we can finally print out a stack trace and get some meaningful information from it.
Uh-huh.
So the method that was being called is called as a result of line item double equals. And then that's the top of or the bottom of the Shopify stuff. Then we're just going into active record code. And all the
uh-huh.
active record code that we're seeing is from dirty checking. And the last call before we get to dirty is in timestamps. So we use a before save callback in active record, and we write if has changes to save, set updated self.updated equals time.now.
Update the timestamps. Yep.
And has changes to save is defined as roughly as attribute names dot any attribute adder name dot changed. And this is the one known difference in behavior of this gem and Rails, is the order of attribute names can be different.
Which shouldn't matter, because
it shouldn't.
Attribute names should be an unordered, unique collection, but Ruby doesn't have that.
Ruby doesn't have that. So the behavior on, because we create these attribute objects lazily in the Ruby version, the order of anything that is built off of the attributes hash that is ordered will be the order that you read them, followed by all of the ones that you didn't read in the order they were defined. Whereas with the gem, where we don't do the laziness, it's always consistently the order they were defined, which I think is actually the correct behavior anyway.
Sure.
Like if there has to be an order. So then if I stuck a before save callback and I did puts changes to save dot keys on master, I saw line items email. And on this branch, I saw email line items. So because email's changed, we never check to see if line item has changed. And so because we don't need to check that, we don't call double equals until later. And therefore, the query does not get executed.
That's ridiculous. Wait, so does that mean that active record double equals can invoke SQL queries, or was this Shopify code?
This was our definition of double equals. No, the implementation of active record double equals is it the same class, and do we have the same ID?
Okay, cool. Oh, and so basically the Shopify override for the double equals method on line item was executed.
Line item is not an active record model, to be clear.
Oh, okay. What was the object type that had the double equals override on it?
A line item.
Active record. It was a line item.
Line item, and it executed active record queries in its in this double equals method, because that's totally happen.
Ooh, that's that. Ooh, yes. That doesn't. I don't know that that sits rightly with me. I'm sure there was a good reason for doing it at the time. Yeah, that's never a place that I would look to try and find SQL queries.
Yeah, no, and so like there's two specific things that made this an absolute nightmare to track down. The first is just that we're doing SQL queries in double equals method. Just like, don't do that ever.
Sure.
But the second, and this is the one that's now going to be more interesting and is going to be what I'm working on basically all week next week, is this test. So this is a test in a group of tests that we have called externals tests, which basically is, here's every external interaction we have with any service of any kind, including all SQL queries and any, you know, Redis or what have you. And we test this on business critical paths. I'm assuming to make sure we don't accidentally introduce a massive performance regression.
So yeah, I mean, it's quite common, right, that the place where you see tests that count or assert on specific SQL queries getting executed is for performance reasons. In the past, I've done things like asserting that runs of code do not try to count the entire table, because counting the entire table would be very slow, and instead going out to the like Postgres like metadata table, which is not the same thing. But if you're, you know, if you're counting a really huge table, you probably don't care whether it's 1.1315729 million or just 1.3 million, right? At that point, like those things are really kind of indifferent.
Well, they'll be even closer than that.
Sure. For example. But yeah, so like that's really interesting as well though, because that's what that's saying is like, this is the exact and precise performance characteristic of this system. If it changes at all, you, the programmer, have to explicitly opt into that change, right?
Right, but the problem is a lot of what it's then asserting is stuff like this is the queries that it was caring about are internal implementation details, or at least the side effect of internal implementation details of Rails. Like this could have just as easily been a minor version bump of Rails or any other gem that we have.
Right. No, and totally. But it's a trade-off, right? Because also, like, it could be that if, say, in Rails, the next version of Rails, you change how, like, one of these things is implemented and suddenly like an assumption about how Shopify is implemented stops holding and suddenly it's executing 200,000 versions of that query. Like, you do actually care about the implementation detail of Rails in performance critical business. Now, like, the sort of counter to that would be, let's assume the Rails developers are never going to introduce that kind of regression.
Well, and I would even widen that to all developers, because I agree with you, it's a trade-off, but I think that we've made the wrong trade-off here, because this cost two senior developers almost 2 weeks of time.
Totally.
And we've seen other people, especially around Rails upgrades, get stuck on these tests for extremely long periods of time as well. And I think it's costing so many developers so much time that we need to, if not eliminate them entirely, at least pare them down and stop caring about, for example, things like SQL queries, which have no side effects.
You know what? This, to me, feels very similar to the, like, outdated VCR cassette problem in its nature, where, like, you've captured the entire behavior of a system and run it and, like, done something and now it's changed, right? And so, like, I actually think, like, and this is possibly just, like, a what are these things for sort of tribal knowledge training documentation problem, but, like, you know, if the case is that no behavior has changed anywhere else in your system and that number changes from, what was it, like 269 to 265, like, that's fine, right? Like, if truly the only reason that that's there is for, well, you actually improved the system by about 3% there.
Yes.
And so, like, that's actually better. So frequently, actually, when I've seen these kind of performance ratchet test, it's like a certain number of SQL queries is less than equal to this value and not is exactly equal to this value, right? And that's actually a better expression of what you care about, assuming that you have good functional testing literally everywhere else, and then you wouldn't have had this problem.
Sure. I mean, the issue with if you're doing less than or equal to, right, is that so the system's better, now we want to make sure that that becomes the new baseline.
Yeah, right. Well, but then you would have ratcheted it down, I guess.
But I would also wager that just, you know, having decent performance monitoring in production and alerts if we hit some threshold is sufficient here. Like, I feel comfortable assuming that any performance regression that gets introduced and makes it through code review will at worst, I can't imagine a regression so bad that it actually starts to take down the system before it gets reverted,
right,
making it through code review.
Yeah, I guess, like, that's totally reasonable. There's some reason to believe this is a, like, good safety engineering is done in layers type practice, right? And or actually, this very specific kind of testing was quite popular in Rails applications like a few years ago, and Shopify has existed since forever. So, like, I do wonder if it's like a sort of remnant historical architectural layer of a previous Rails trend that maybe people aren't doing anymore, right? I would actually be super fascinated to know if the set of people who built these tests in the first place is still around, and if they can sort of remember the context and original motivation in which they were created, right?
Well, I mean, it's such a large group of tests. There's not any, like, individual person who you can really say, like, this was your decision in this case.
Sure. I mean, or just pick one of the original authors at random and have a conversation with, like, because I'm going to go out on a limb here, and this is not calling people at Shopify out. This is calling developers in general out, that the commit history probably does not greatly illuminate on exactly why this it came to be, right?
Oh, yes. That is a problem that I run into quite frequently.
And so I, like, putting my sort of code is a product of organizations hat on, I would, like, try and find whoever the earliest committer of a test of this form is and be like, yo, why did you do this and how did it catch on, right? I think that would be really interesting.
That would be. In the short term, what I'm doing, because the funny thing is, so now I found the root cause of the failure. I now know it is actually just safe to change the test.
Yeah.
And I know the lines that are adding these assertions, and I can't figure out which ones to delete.
Why? Oh, because you don't know which
every combination I've tried, it still fails.
Oh, so there is no, like, assert query count is equal to 269 anywhere.
No, it's asserting every single query individually, whether or not it hit the query cache and what order that happened in addition to every other interaction other service.
So you now need to generate the entire log of queries from the beginning to end of the test and update the test,
right? Assuming this is the only difference, which I'm now fairly confident if there are any other differences, like, it's not something we need to care about.
I mean, is there any reason you can't like just like have Active Record print the queries somewhere and then paste them over the existing test and move on with your life?
No, because it's not like it's not structured like a VCR cassette. It's all actual Ruby code. And like the part of the problem is there's only four places where it talks about this table. That's that's getting hit 269 times. So presumably this is getting put into, you know, this method's getting called and put into another array multiple times. So if I just edit it in the one place, now it's expecting too few queries in other cases where line item is the only thing that changed.
But why?
Right. So that's why I'm going to be pushing. I pulled somebody from the checkouts team to come help me with this next week. And, you know, worst case, we'll just figure out a way to change the test. But what I'm actually going to start pushing for is I don't know that I would succeed if I tried to say we should start to eliminate these types of tests entirely. But I do think, hey, let's stop caring about select statements is probably going to be a little bit more palatable. And I think I've got a good case to make on this is costing us so much time, and I can't imagine that the actual benefit having this test is giving us outweighs that cost.
Yeah, no, that's yes. Absolutely, certainly. Assuming you have a reasonable strategy around read replicas in production, there's no reason to really care about your select volume if it's like reasonable. And like, it's reasonably hard to get Rails to generate unreasonable query volumes. Like, you have to really be trying. And plus, as we've spoken about in our previous episodes, you know, it sounds like you have decent production monitoring as well. So that doesn't,
yeah,
that doesn't seem like it would be an issue, particularly around things that are not mutating state. I could see how if you were mutating state that like you want exact queries to happen. But again, like,
right,
that's like,
oh, and this is a business critical path. So I'm completely fine with we will have more brittle tests that are really, 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 you know.
Yeah. I mean, this is really funny. If I was giving my sort of most generalized version of my testing advice, I would advise you to delete that entire section of your test suite.
And that's what I would like to do. I just don't know that I don't know that I will actually be able to convince other folks outside of the Rails team of that. The Rails team is pretty much on the same page that, yeah, these tests just aren't worth having at all.
Sure. And they're owned by teams like across many different verticals within Shopify. Like, it's sort of all over the place.
I'm assuming, I actually haven't looked at how many of them there are. The one that I'm at right now is owned by the checkouts team, which, I mean, as you can imagine, checkout is a critical business path for an e-commerce company.
Yeah, but the thing is, right, like, exactly locking which SQL statements happened in what order in a single threaded testing environment probably isn't giving you that much useful information about how your application behaves, right?
Right.
Like, I'm sort of thinking about the classic testing pyramid that Justin and I like to carve out, where you completely delete the middle and only have the very most integrated and the very most isolated tests. And like, this is neither, right? This is like a sort of weird in the middle, deeply interconnected, but not really integration test that kind of sucks. Because it's backdooring everything. Actually, in fact, that's why this is problematic, right? Is it's an end-to-end test that's backdooring the universe. And that's always a recipe for brittle tests that break all the time. And especially given that it's sort of materially dependent on Rails's internals, like, I can sort of follow the logical chain of why someone might have built one of these in the first place. And especially if the context in which it got developed was a less mature production environment, it kind of makes more sense. But yeah, I don't know that that's a strong argument. I would be interested to see where that conversation goes.
Well, because the big problem isn't that they're brittle, right? It's that when they break, it's not obvious that the solution is just change it to whatever the new flow is, because you don't necessarily know why this query stopped happening. In this case, it did turn out to be benign, but it could have just as easily been a bug in fast attributes. You know, I couldn't just say, okay, so the query is getting executed four fewer times. That's completely fine until we really actually properly went in and found the root cause.
I only kind of maybe agree with you there. And the reason is that, like, I assume alongside this test, you have a functional test over, like, the actual behavior of the system, right?
Yes.
So, like, if I saw a test like that and literally all of my other tests related to the same piece of code were passing, and especially given the, like, nature of the change fast attributes represents, I would be almost 0% especially with select statements. If it was an update statement or a insert statement or a delete statement, I might have more concern, but especially with select statements, I would have no concern. And like, I sort of I admire your willingness to dig.
I generally agree with you. And I, going into this, was fairly confident that it was either going to be this exactly this. I was more expecting it to be like something that mutated the array if changes equals array of two elements, which therefore means, you know, exact order.
Yeah,
that's what I was expecting it to find. But I was expecting it to either, yeah, be something that was caused by some benign thing that was caused, actually not necessarily benign, but something that was caused by the change in ordering, or a bug in Rails that fast attributes gem fixes.
Yeah,
I was pretty confident it was going to be one of those two things. I disagree that I should feel that way because of the nature of fast attributes. Because fast attributes is so experimental, and part of this whole we're going to be testing it ourselves before making it public is to help me build confidence that it does not break stuff. The other thing is, like, yes, we do have functional tests, but this isn't a part of the code base that I interact with very often. So I don't know that I can have the confidence to say, and there's definitely no edge case this could have hit that doesn't have a functional test that would have broken.
Let me ask you, do you reckon if you'd had somebody from the checkouts team eyeball, because it was just the one test that was failing, right, across all of Shopify?
Yes.
Okay.
There were two that were caused by the ordering, but the other one was way easier to track down because it was literally assert changes equals this array.
Right. Yeah. So at that point, I probably would have had someone from my checkouts team like eyeball this, and they probably would have been like, yeah, you know what, that thing breaks all the time. Like, I would be really interesting to know. And this is a thing I actually talked about on a podcast with Noel Rapin and Justin Searles. Like, none of our CI systems give us per test like build history. I bet that test has broken every single time you've changed like your Rails version.
Yes. Like,
every single.
I mean, I don't know if it's exactly this test, but for sure tests in the, you know, these checkout externals tests and other externals tests break all the time, every Rails update.
Yeah. And so like, if you had really good CI history on that, like, I do mean specifically like on a per build basis, that as well would have probably given me confidence. I don't know. I think you sort of see where I'm coming from.
No, and I agree with you. And honestly, it probably would have been fine. But, you know, it was basically just because it was checkout specifically, yeah, that I that don't, I don't took break. The really, really cautious pass.
don't break Shopify.
Yeah. But I will say, you know, having dug through all this and then finally figuring out exactly what it, like, part of it's also I would have personally felt very dissatisfied,
sure,
with like, because this gem should be functionally equivalent other than this one known change. So part of it, too, is if there was another difference in behavior that was like benign but different, that would also be something I would want to document. But yeah, I would have been very like, it was very satisfying to finally find it and go, oh, my God. OK, good. It's not a bug. It's just this really obscure interaction between stuff.
Have you considered faking the way like the Ruby ordering of attribute names comes back in the like Rust code that you've written so as to like not have this bug?
I have. It will cause performance problems if I try.
Gotcha.
Similarly, I would love to, on the Ruby side, I would actually prefer to change the Ruby code to match fast attributes ordering, because I think if we have to have an order, this order is better.
Yeah, I agree, especially because it does, like, that doesn't change once your model is done being defined, which is
exactly,
is kind of like, feels much nicer to me.
Yeah, the only reason it would ever change is if you have additional stuff returned by your query that aren't predefined attributes, but then they'll just always be at the end and they'll always be in the order we got them from the database.
Gotcha.
But that's the only reason like one instance of a model would have a different ordering. But similarly, I would love to, I can't make that change on the Ruby side either, because that will also hurt before. I actually don't even know how I would do that, to be honest.
Yeah, you'd probably have to do like, you'd probably have to make that method do a like reorder every time it gets invoked, right? And so that would,
yeah,
probably,
the square brackets method, like, definitely, yeah, you'd have to like delete and reinsert. That's the problem. It actually doesn't have to delete that one element, it has to delete every element that's supposed to come after it.
Yeah,
and then reinsert them in the right order.
Yeah, that would be terrible for performance, but very satisfying from an API design perspective.
Yes. Or we could just have unordered hashes in Ruby. That would be great.
Sure. This is a great example of Rust solving all programming problems immediately, always, for free. It solves your API design problem and your performance problem for free. Don't question it. It's great. Don't question it.
Well, you know, that was one thing that made the decision to use Rust here really pay off, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Was when I was joking, like, I'm going to use Rust instead of C because I know I need a hash map, and Rust has a built-in hash map. that was about a joke, and like that, frankly, I think a decent reason.
Sure.
But then I got about two-thirds of the way through implementing it and realized, oh crap, I need to preserve insertion order. Here's a test that says, and we preserve insertion order. So like, if this were C, suddenly it's now, well, I guess I'm restarting the whole thing from scratch because the entire code base would be super, super coupled to that specific hash map API, which would not mirror others. Whereas Rust, it's just extern create order map and then replace all instances of the word hash with the word order.
Yeah.
And we're done.
Totally. Cool. Anything else on this topic?
I guess not. I'll be back with updates in the next episode, I'm sure, as to what we end up doing.
Yeah, I really want to know what the purpose of these things is and whether or not you can just end up deleting them all.
Oh, I did actually want to say one other thing, though.
Please, go ahead.
Too. I am glad that I end up going down this path of finding the solution, though, because I would actually now feel really, really confident in the gem.
Right.
I'm actually also even now becoming very confident that the order change of attribute names won't really break the vast majority of apps out there, because like the amount of things that need to interact in the wrong way to cause one failure in all of Shopify is pretty impressive.
Totally. And Shopify is, you know, one of the largest Rails apps there is, probably, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, our test suite is parallelized over 100 physical machines, and, you know, we run 8 minutes worth of tests per machine. We have a lot of tests.
Yeah. It might be really interesting to approach people at, like, Procore and GitHub and be like, hey, would you mind slapping this in and seeing if it passes your test suites as well?
That I will be, once I'm ready to make it public, I will put, like, we're pretty sure this is fine, but it's still experimental flag on it, and then do a more public call out, like, hey, don't put this in production, please run your test suite against it.
Yeah, so I would totally volunteer, but we don't have any big Rails 5 apps. Our biggest internal Rails application is still on 3.2, God bless.
Oof.
And all of our public-facing ones are now 4.2, which is nice.
So I guess Rails LTS gets some money from y'all.
Or we just have it behind our VPN and not exposed to the internet, and so that's probably fine. That's probably fine. It's an internal application is the only reason that one hasn't gotten the update yet. But it's coming, I hope. So speaking of which, Rails is really fast. Oh my god, building software in Rails is really fast. So
it is.
This week I had the most classic Rails like feature request ever. So at DigitalOcean, we get inbound abuse complaints from people who want to complain about people doing bad things on our network, right? Like every large ISP on the planet does this. There are various forms that they come in. And there's this automated framework for abuse reporting called XARF, which basically is like a way of describing the kind of abuse that you're complaining about, who did it, and at what timestamps, so that like you can go into your database of users and look up what was going on.
And to be clear, when you talk about abuse, you're not talking like copyright infringement. You're talking somebody is doing stuff on your machines that is some like for DOS attacks or some form of hacking or something that's against the law.
Copyright infringement is also in there. Outbound brute force, outbound DDoS, hosting malware. Like basically, if it's like illegal or bad to do on the internet, someone is probably trying to do it on DigitalOcean. This is a fundamental fact of being a hosting provider, is that like if it's bad, people will try to do it.
But I just want to make sure that you're not like just talking about DMCA takedown notices or anything like
that. We get a lot of those, but we also get,
as I would imagine.
But and so actually the XARF framework includes all of the things you just listed, right? It has categories for all of them, fields that you must include for each explicit form of complete, like it's basically like a big JSON schema for how to automatically file abuse complaints. Our trust and safety team asked me to like build them a little internal reader tool that could parse these fields out, as opposed to just them having to read a bunch of email. And so I basically knocked out what you might call the world's simplest email client. Like that basically, so we accept the inbound email through a Mandrill webhook, put them in a database, and then like a Rails app renders the complaints out of the database. And so within like 2 hours, I had like pagination, like the index page search, like the whole thing just working. And I was like, Rails is so fast. Rails is so, and this is like a shiny new 5.2 app. It has system tests. It was really fun. I had forgotten.
That's the sort of thing where Rails really shines, I think.
Yeah, I was just like, I need to put some HTML on a web page, like, quickly from this database, and it just happened. And yeah, like, I wrote a very small series of tests. Like, really, it was basically like, does the index page, does the show page, and that was kind of it, right? And like, oh, Rails is great.
I think people, when comparing Rails to newer technologies, tend to undervalue the maturity of the ecosystem.
Right.
Because like you were just saying, pagination, right? That's just one of those, there's three or four gems that are sure, you know, have different trade-offs, but like there's several, there will be generally multiple good solutions for whatever generic problem you have.
I actually didn't even use a gem. I just did like per page equals limit offset done, right? Like,
that works too.
Are there more? Are there not more? Like, really, that's also super easy because Active Record, like, and then the caching, I was like, let's just throw some caching on it because it's best practice. And this is really, it was great. Yeah.
Just rub some cache on it.
Yeah. I mean, look, the nested action view caching essentially is unbreakable as long as you use it correctly. So like,
as long as you don't change helpers or the definition of the methods that you call inside the view.
Sure. But like, well, I mean, it gets blown every time you redeploy anyway, right?
No, I mean, you can blow it every time you redeploy. It doesn't do that by default.
Interesting. Okay, well, I mean, sure,
because the whole point is like there are apps that basically are unusable if their cache is cold.
Oh yeah, we definitely
not naming any names, but you know, maybe the folks who made this decision to not blow the cache every time we redeploy an app that is unusable if the cache is cold.
Well, I mean, we sure, it turns out like loading a model and doing a single join is always fast. Unless the database isn't there anymore.
I mean, if the database isn't there anymore, it's still fast. It's just not the result you want. It'll explode quickly.
Yeah. And like just the smallest sprinkling of JavaScript to make the search a little bit more usable.
Yeah.
But certainly nothing fancy. This is also the first time I've written a Rails application without jQuery in it, which was an interesting experience as well. Now that
did you do much that you would have used jQuery for? Like,
well,
presumably it was just like document.query selector all, right?
Yeah. See, when I learned to program JavaScript, jQuery was really the only way that you could do anything. And so because jQuery has persisted and was, you know, vended with Rails for so long, I kind of have like bad habit muscle memory to just like immediately type dollar open parenthesis anytime I want to do anything.
Oh, me too.
And so I actually spent the time to fight that instinct. So yeah, all vanilla JavaScript. Because all of our users for this application are internal, we can assume they're using modern browsers. So I didn't even need a modern JavaScript transpiler. You can just write it and the browser will just execute it now, right?
So you're just doing ES6 stuff.
Yeah.
And it just works.
Yeah, it just works because like literally 100% of our users use latest Chrome and latest Firefox.
Right.
So this was a dream. It was like,
well, and even like if you're talking about query selector all, right, you don't even need to restrict yourself to like IE8 supported it.
Sure. Yeah. But like it was just really nice having like a completely fresh, completely modern stack to play with. And everything just kind of working. I also got to do some slightly interesting Elasticsearch programming. Gosh, that thing is magic. You just like upload documents into it and it just searches them correctly for you.
Yeah, I am a fan of not using that until you get to the point where it's really clear that Postgres full text search isn't enough for you.
MySQL, baby.
Well, then, yeah, your life just apparently is going to be terrible because you're using MySQL.
I mean, we're pretty good at operating systems, so I was like, yeah, this is, I mean, we have a playbook for operating Elasticsearch. It's not like I was just inventing my own, right?
No, of course. I'm a fan of introducing as few moving parts into a system as is necessary. Not saying that Elasticsearch is never necessary. There are definitely cases where it becomes necessary, but for most applications, like, you'd be surprised how far you can get with just Postgres full text search.
No, I absolutely totally believe you and agree with you.
But you don't have Postgres, so it's moot.
Yeah, honestly, the way in which I live my life right now is that adding moving parts often makes my life easier because I own the moving part and don't have to rely on somebody else's moving part, which is like an interesting trade-off. But yeah, I just I just wanted to enthuse about how good Rails is. If you just need to jam some HTML onto a page from some data, it's really fast. I like truly had forgotten how quick and easy it was to build stuff.
Yeah,
especially Greenfield.
I think that's the problem, right? Is we as a community tend to get jaded because we don't do as much Greenfield stuff.
Yeah, I actually gave a whole talk about this last year. I was like, we really need to think about Rails as a framework that is supporting like big multi-million dollar businesses now, because that's not like a rare case anymore, right? There are, you know, dozens of companies that we could name that have either Rails as most of their stack or like part of their stack that have $100 million plus year revenues that are built on Rails, right? And so like thinking about how Rails works in those worlds, and particularly in the talk that I gave, I framed it as a function of Rails is really bad at working in a microservices architecture. We should make it easier for Rails to work in a microservices architecture, because that is not like a rare case anymore, right? And like people's lives would be made easier if Rails was good at that, for sure.
Yeah, they'd be made even easier if we stopped trying to do microservices architectures, but...
Microservices architectures are really good for some problems, Sean. Ask me how I
know. For some problems.
Ask me how I know.
How do you know?
I have a cloud. It's my pet cloud. Me and my...
We don't, let's not go into a deep discussion about microservices today, but you know, sure. You know, but just so folks know, I'm not advocating like, and therefore monolith. I'm saying that there's a thing called service-oriented architecture, which is not microservices,
and
has been forgotten.
I mean, I will say parenthetically here that that's a better representation of how DigitalOcean actually works, right? Is like the scale of services goes from hundreds of lines of code to hundreds of thousands of lines of code, like easily, right? An example, I think a really good example of this would be like our Droplet service is like, it's sort of like a monolith made of small but highly interconnected services, right? And so like, the actual Droplet service itself is not that big, but things that it would not be able to operate correctly without, once you combine them all together and form them as like a single box on the architecture diagram, that's like a good, I would guess, 10 to 50,000 lines of total code, right? And so the Droplet system could not possibly operate without all of those, right? And so like when we talk about microservices and service architectures, like I also don't believe you should only write tiny services. That's a horrible idea. The truth lies somewhere in the middle, is I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah. Shockingly, a conclusion that there are trade-offs and middle grounds. It's never the case in software.
Totally. Cool. Should we wrap?
Yeah, let's wrap up. Show notes for this episode can be found at yakshave.fm/3.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are appreciated.
If you have feedback on this episode or any of our other episodes, you can email us at hosts@yakshave.fm, tweet at us @_yakshave, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to the Yakshave, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is sponsored by Shopify. Shopify builds products that help entrepreneurs around the world start and grow their businesses. Shopify is now a team of over 3,000 with offices and remote teams across the globe. They're growing quickly and building an international team that will define the future of entrepreneurship. Visit shopify.com/careers to find out what they're working on.